Now, our next speaker is going to bring a little bit closer to home by talking about ERM in a banking environment. And we're very lucky to have Jackie Colwell here today, who is the Chief Risk Officer for NAB Personal Banking. And just to put that in context, when Jackie formerly was the manager of NAB Banking just in Victoria and Tasmania, she was managing $34 billion in lending and $17 billion in deposits. So they're very big sums of money. It's an incredibly important area. This is NAB's reporting week, and Jackie's under pretty strict gag orders. So unfortunately, she's had to take out all the detailed stuff about what the results will be, and we can't ask her about that. But I'm sure she'll give us very interesting insights into how NAB, such a big organisation, is approaching ERM. So give her a big welcome, Jackie Colwell.
Thank you. Well, a little bit back down to earth. So we've had the view from 30,000 feet. I'll probably give you the view from the 35th floor, so it may not be quite as exciting as the aviation industry. But listening to Mark speak, I thought there's actually a lot of similarities between managing risk in the aviation industry and managing it in the banking industry, in that Mark talked a lot about keeping passengers safe, and it's not much different at NAB, because what we look to do is keep our customers safe, and in particular keep their money safe. So let's look at how the industry has moved. I'm sure many of these headlines here are familiar to all of you. And I'm sure many of you are still as concerned today as you were when these situations arose, many of which were contributors to the GFC. I think we all ask the questions, how did this happen? Why did anyone not predict this? And what were the risk management processes in place that allowed this to occur? It's actually interesting to review some of these failures in risk management and identify the common themes, which really came down to four key areas: a lack of effective risk frameworks, poor risk governance, excessive risk appetite, and inappropriate compensation or incentives. So when you link many of these themes together, it often gets classified as a failure of risk culture. And I'd like to just quickly review some of the examples that came from some of the reviews. So the report into UBS's issues in 2008 talked about a culture that didn't address violations vigorously enough, a culture where compliance and controls were perceived as obstacles and therefore were implemented half-heartedly. There were weak signals from the top and lack of encouragement or appreciation for critical voices. There was a culture of looking the other way. In the Sols Review of Barclays in 2012, the report summarised a culture that favoured transactions over sustainability or relationships, the short term over the long term, and valuing financial outcomes over other business purposes, and a sense that senior management did not want to hear the bad news. The US Senate Committee report into the JP Morgan CIO losses in 2013 said that the whale trades exposed a culture in which risk metrics were frequently criticised or downplayed, and risk evaluation models were targeted to produce artificially lower capital requirements. An interesting insight around risk governance was various managers gave different answers as to who the CRO was for the division. The FSA report and findings on Peter Cummings of HBOS referred to a culture where risk management was regarded as a constraint on business rather than integral to it. There was resistance to change or improvements in the control framework, and a culture of optimisation which created a bias to take on risk and a reluctance to refer stressed assets or to escalate problems. In the FSA inquiry into RBS, the report identified underlying deficiencies, governance arrangements, checks and balances, mechanisms for oversight and challenge, And in its culture, particularly its attitude to the balance between risk-taking and growth. What this report summarised that all of this made RBS prone to making poor decisions. And what it questioned was whether the challenge from the risk function was as effective as it should have been. So fast forward to 2014, and what does all this mean for risk management? What changes have occurred and what changes are still required? So one of the key elements of enterprise risk management is ensuring risk appetite for the enterprise is clearly articulated and is clearly defined. Risk management is not and should not be seen as an isolated add-on process, but should be considered an integral part of the strategic planning process. New strategic initiatives often provide exciting opportunities. However, the expected rewards need to be balanced against the potential risks. We need to ensure that good risk management does not equal risk avoidance. It's always about making informed choices about the risks associated with objectives the organisation wishes to pursue, and then ensuring that appropriate controls are in place to mitigate those risks. So the banking industry is a good example of this. Managing risk is actually the business of banking. Essentially, we earn money from taking risk. Therefore, it is essential when considering new products or services that could enhance or increase our revenues that we understand the external factors that could increase the risk to a level where losses would make returns on the product unsustainable. So a good current example of this is the drive from consumers for increasing the levels of innovation in mobile and online banking. Around 50% of all logons to internet banking now come through the mobile internet banking channel, while funds transfers and BPAY via mobile internet banking have increased 55% and 76% respectively year on year. These trends continue to increase. However, this all needs to be balanced against the potential losses arising from increases in operational risk from fraud and cybercrime. Greg Medcraft from ASIC just the other week highlighted this in a recent speech to be the next potential black swan event. The challenge is that the business is keen to drive new and innovative mobile banking apps and products in this space which meet the consumer needs and help the bank to gain new customers by being the first to market. But it is essential that appropriate controls are in place to minimise fraud before launching these new products. Often by the time the controls are designed and implemented, cyber criminals are already working on a new way to undermine them. The issue of big data is also important here, as leaders of companies in all industries need to understand the potential risks. This has been recently highlighted with the use of malware to hack the point-of-sale systems of US retailer Target, where they stole debit and credit information of more than 110 million of their customers. I mentioned earlier the Sol's review into Barclays, where the LIBOR issues were discussed. The report comments on the SFA views that at particular periods, some of this occurred as a result of senior management attempting to influence the financial results of the bank at the peak of the GFC. This was clearly the result of not having a risk appetite that balances both the risks and the opportunities. And if it did exist, it was not clearly articulated throughout the organisation. So whilst it is important to have a clear risk appetite across the enterprise, effective risk management involves the implementation of the three lines of defence as part of any good risk management framework, particularly in the financial services sector. The objective is to embed a robust risk management framework which links management of risk to business strategy, having clear defined accountabilities, and ensures the business continues to generate sustainable returns. So NAB, we have implemented the three lines of defence model, with the first line of defence being the business ownership of risk. So the emphasis for first line accountabilities is to identify and control risk whilst assessing the effectiveness of these processes. So this includes monitoring, testing, inspections and managing risk events. So how that plays out within Personal Bank, it's actually the people who run our retail branches, our call centres, and all of those customer-facing areas. We term those as our first line of defence. So the second line of defence is the risk function, which I lead as the Chief Risk Officer. So our role is we're focused on ensuring that frameworks, business profiles, and first line and monitoring and testing activities are designed effectively. The key focus is to ensure the provision of strategic risk insight and oversight to enable effective management within appetite. It is also a key responsibility of second line to provide effective challenge to the first line. So how that plays out is I sit on the Personal Bank leadership team, and my role in that committee is, I suppose, to challenge some of those business strategies. And often I can say, whilst my challenge is effective, in many instances I would say it's not always welcomed. The third line of defence is the provision by audit of independent assurance through formal reviews around the effectiveness, adequacy and completeness of our risk and control framework and processes. So successful implementation of the three lines of defence model ensures risk optimisation and better decision making as business decisions are informed by the first line of defence risk management. Improved agility to respond to emerging risks and opportunities, and improved ability to address the risk-reward trade-off. Nobody has responsibility for just risk, and nobody has responsibility for just return. And it ends with closer integration of risk management thinking in strategy development and execution. You soon develop a business-wide understanding and respect for risk appetite. So what went wrong at Barclays and HBOS, given both banks operated a three lines of defence model? Whilst the concept is straightforward, the implementation is quite difficult in complex organisations, particularly where the operating model is relatively decentralised, such as in Barclays and HBOS. Decentralised organisations can blur the lines between first and second lines, since control functions exist and often report within business units. Where control functions feel greater affinity to the business units they are supposed to control, they can lose the degree of independence. This is clearly what happened in these two organisations, where the second line was not providing effective challenge, or there was no method for providing identification of or reporting of high-risk sales practices. The first line had become hostage to the business, particularly in a highly competitive environment where there was pressure for management to perform equal to or better than their competitors. So the three lines of defence model is the preferred model of regulators, including our regulator here in Australia, APRA, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, and the FSA from the UK. However, there are still challenges with implementation which require strong support from executive management to ensure that we learn from the lessons from the past. Some of the examples where it doesn't work is where there is confusion around ownership of risk. There is potential for first line managers to believe they don't need the second line, that they're the owners of the risk. Misalignment of business decisions and risk consequences. A focus on systems and not the root causes. Second line can be ignored by the business as they are perceived as not being commercial. There can often be a lack of insight from the second line and too much focus on administration and reporting. Second line are often seen as the handbrake to happiness, and the third line are often perceived as too focused on control and processes rather than actual risk. So, will a well-defined risk appetite, which has been board-approved, has had executive management input and support, and has been clearly articulated throughout the organisation, combined with a strong accountability model, be enough for effective enterprise risk management? Many of the examples I pointed to earlier today all point to the missing link in the chain, which is around risk culture. The FSB report indicates that risk culture plays an important role in influencing the actions and decisions taken by individuals within the institution and in shaping the institution's attitude towards its stakeholders. Weaknesses in the risk management framework, as well as in the decision-making processes and in assigning clear accountability for identifying and addressing behaviours not supportive of sound risk management, enable particular risks to take root and grow. So in this report, the FSB identifies four indicators of a sound risk culture. Tone from the top, accountability, effective challenge, and appropriate incentives. So as we learn the lessons from the past and look forward, there is a significant increase in all financial institutions and a focus on culture and its link to risk management decisions. So what we look at is the attitude and practices to risk-taking by an organisation. The term culture is subjective, and we need to ensure that this does not become a measure of form over substance, and that we do not build a framework around culture and we just tick the box. It is crucial that we differentiate between a risk culture and a compliance culture. From the reviews of some of the failings of institutions I talked about today, a clearly understood risk culture won't protect any organisation from rogue elements or deviant subcultures. A gold-plated control framework will similarly not be totally effective. So what is still required for today's enterprise risk function to ensure that our focus is not just on frameworks and processes, but that we can clearly articulate and support the boundaries that enable business units to operate within risk appetite while achieving the strategic and financial objectives? That we are focused on substance, not form, and that we communicate the risk profile of the organisation in clear, unambiguous terms, and that we have the confidence and skill to constructively challenge and advise. So linking appetite, accountability and culture will help organisations to ensure that risk management is seen as a fundamental condition to long-term sustainability. That risk management is not seen as a constraint on business activity. We need to ensure that we have mobility of our senior and middle management into and out of risk functions to get a balanced approach and a broader understanding of risk management. We need to ensure that our risk frameworks are easy to understand and execute, and risk decisions are balanced, considering all of the stakeholders. And the last one, understanding that risk-taking and risk controls in our organisation are consistent with that organisation's purpose. So if in the future we are to avoid instances such as those outlined today, it is important that we understand both culture and controls are in a constant state of flux and need to be actively managed and adjusted. Complacency must be avoided, and organisations must be aware enough to ensure that they don't end up in a state of self-delusion. So an example of that, The Economist published a report in 2010 on financial risk, which reviewed a number of issues exposed during the GFC. In the report, it sought to draw on examples of organisations that were seemingly successful. It in particular referred to one organisation who had given risk managers equal status to risk takers, how the CEO set the tone and described him as a voracious reader of internal reports, who understood the financials and subjected staff to detailed questioning. how PowerPoint presentations were discouraged, informal discussions of what could go wrong encouraged, and that as an organisation it took a conservative view of risk mitigation. Following this comment, that particular CEO and company suffered some significant losses as a result of failing to notice the changes and would perhaps not be described the same way today. Thank you.